Japan's nuclear disaster was awful, but it turns out the emotions triggered by the crisis were worse than the actual radiation. NPR's Richard Harris reports on the cost of fear.
There is no bright line that separates a safe dose of radiation from a dangerous dose. But at some point, a dose is so small, any potential health risk is too small to measure. That's the case for the radiation clouds that settled on northern Japan last March. John Boyce is a radiation expert at Vanderbilt University.
Surprisingly, there have been no health effects that have been demonstrated among the Japanese people or among the workers.
That's a surprise because we all watched frightening TV images, and clouds of radioactive steam did erupt from the plant, and that material did sometimes move over the countryside and into populated areas. So it looked like a horrible disaster.
No, that's exactly right. There was radiation release, but most of the releases were blown off to the Pacific Ocean. The winds were blowing to the sea and not to populated areas.
Most people were quickly evacuated. About 170,000 people live close to the plant. Boyce says that helped limit dangerous doses. So did other quick actions by the Japanese government.
They prohibited the release of any food that had increased levels of radiation in them. So there wasn't milk out there in the public supply. There wasn't fish that had any levels that were increased.
And that's a huge difference from the aftermath of Chernobyl. The Soviets in 1986 let people eat contaminated food and drink contaminated milk. That led to many cancers. Robert Gale treated workers after Chernobyl. He also spent half the last year in Japan. He's been talking to some of the thousands of workers called in for the nuclear cleanup.
Most of these workers are not nuclear workers. They are common workers that, you know, were upholstering couches in, you know, in Osaka, and now they're cleaning up a nuclear reactor.
They work until they reach the occupational radiation limit of 50 millisieverts in a year. Then they go home. But they don't know what their risk really entails, so Dr. Gale meets with them to explain.
Usually when they're discussing these issues, we're in an izakaya, you know, sort of a Japanese bar. While they're discussing their concerns about radiation with me, they can go through a pack of cigarettes. And, you know, if you smoke a pack of cigarettes a day for a year, you're getting an internal radiation dose of about 30 millisieverts.
30 for smoking 1 year versus 50 by working at the ruined plant. Plus, cigarettes are filled with cancer-causing chemicals, so smoking is a far bigger risk to their health. But the issue isn't just physical health, it's the worries that come with radiation.
Concerns about the future health of the children.
Evelyn Bromet is a psychiatry researcher at SUNY Stony Brook.
So that's what happened in Japan, just as it happened after Chernobyl and after Three Mile Island.
Only in Japan, the public is also suffering from the trauma of the tsunami. They're suffering from the trauma of evacuation, the trauma of losing livelihoods because people won't buy produce from Fukushima. And Bromet says physicians in Japan generally don't treat mental health issues.
So I think it's not going to be very easy to set up intervention programs in the same way it would be in a country where they're, like Holland, for example, where there's much more integrated mental and physical health care.
Bromet says it will be essential to deal with both physical health and mental health in the years to come. Richard Harris, NPR News.
And let's come back home for our next story. Here in the U.S., most of us tap into the nation's electricity grid every single day. This web of power stations, transformers, and transmission lines spans the continent, distributing electricity, a central part of the economy, and possibly even powering the radio you're listening to now. But the grid is outdated. The problem is that the kind of electricity that's now flowing through the grid is changing. As NPR's Christopher Joyce reports, energy experts say the grid is not ready for it.
The National Academy of Engineering in Washington, D.C., once asked its members to pick the greatest engineering achievement ever. Their choice? The electrification of the country through what's known as the grid. Ernest Moniz, director of the Energy Institute at MIT, says they were right on the money.
That reflects what an amazing machine this is, spread out geographically, always having to balance demand and supply because electricity is not stored.
Electricity has to keep flowing all the time. Grid operators constantly match what power plants are producing with what people and their TVs, microwaves, and air conditioners need. It's the world's biggest balancing act. And that's doable largely because big power plants run almost constantly and produce a predictable amount of electricity. So what happens when you add in unpredictable sources of electricity, like wind or solar power?
the operator does not have control of when to turn it on and off. It's a new challenge that we just have to meet. And we're not doing it at anything like the pace that I think we need.
That's the conclusion of a study that Moniz's group at MIT is issuing today. It's all about how the grid must change to handle the fickle flow of electrons from renewable energy. Steve Berberich runs the California Independent System Operator. That's the California grid. They're trying to sort out how to handle this on-again, off-again source of electricity.
We have to have a backup. There are times when Mother Nature decides to bring in clouds and turn off the wind. And I think everybody in that case still wants to have power.
In California, most of that backup power comes from plants that burn natural gas. They can switch on and off in a matter of minutes. But Berberich says natural gas plants face some obstacles. Gas plants have to compete against the very renewable energy sources they're supposed to back up.
They're not getting as much revenue as they once did because they're not selling as much power because it's being displaced by wind and solar energy, which is exactly what we want. But we do have to find a way to make sure we maintain those things.
Gas plants have to make money to survive. Keeping them idle until a rainy or cloudy day to back up renewables won't pay the bills. Coal and nuclear plants, thermal plants as MIT's Moniz calls them, are not a good option for backup. It's costly to start and stop them on short notice.
Another set of costs is the additional operating costs and maintenance costs, wear and tear, on some of these thermal plants that we may be asking to go up and down a lot more than they were planned for.
As the cost of solar and wind energy drops, though, the grid is going to use more of it. Many states demand it, so the grid must adapt. Michael Goggin at the American Wind Energy Association is trying to figure out how to do that. They're the biggest industry group for wind energy.
We're adding new energy sources, and obviously the old rules don't necessarily always work.
Goggin says, however, solving this problem is not as hard as MIT makes it out to be.
I think there's a lot of misconceptions about backup power. The reality is that all power plants are backed up by all other power plants.
Andy says grid operators could accommodate the vagaries of wind and solar if they moved power around the grid minute by minute instead of hour by hour, as most do now. One thing the experts agree on, since wind and solar energy are all about the weather, grid operators will need to hire a lot more weather forecasters. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.